Chapter 43. Pontesordo, to the west of the city, notorious for its malaria, has renounced the monopoly of corn and tobacco, has taken the university out of the hands of the Barnabites, and introduced the teaching of the physical sciences, formerly prohibited by the church, has spent since his accession near 200,000 liv. On improving the roads throughout the duchy, and is now engaged in framing a constitution which shall deprive the clergy of the greatest part of their privileges, and confirm the sovereign's right to annex ecclesiastical territory for the benefit of the people. In spite of these radical measures, His Highness is not popular with the masses. He is accused of irreligion by the monks, that he has removed from the university, and his mistress, the daughter of a noted freethinker who was driven from Piedmont by the Inquisition, is said to have an unholy influence over him. I am told these rumors are diligently fomented by the late Duke's minister, now prior of the Dominican monastery, a man of bigoted views but great astuteness. The truth is, the people are so completely under the influence of the friars, that a word is enough to turn them against their truest benefactors. In the afternoon I was setting out to visit the bishop's gallery, when Count Tresker's secretary waited on me with an invitation to inspect the estates of the Marchioness of Boscofolto. An offer I readily accepted, for what are the masterpieces of Raffel or Cleomans to the sight of a good turnip field, or of a well-kept dairy? I had heard of Boscofolto, which was given by the late Duke to his mistress, as one of the most productive estates of the duchy, but great was my disappointment on beholding it. Fine gardens there are, to be sure, clipped walks, leaden statues, and waterworks. But as for the farms, all is dirt, neglect, disorder. Spite of the lady's wealth, all are let out Alameda, and farmed on principles that would disgrace a savage. The spade used instead of the plow, the hedges neglected, mole casts in the pastures, good land run to waste, the peasants starving and indebted where, with a little thrift and humanity, all had been smiling plenty. Learned that on the owner's death this great property reverts to the Barnabites. From Boscofolto to the Church of the Madonna del Monte, where is one of their wonder-working images, said to be annually visited by close on 30,000 pilgrims. But there is always some exaggeration in such figures. A fine building, richly adorned, and hung with an extraordinary number of votive offerings. Silver arms, legs, hearts, wax images, and paintings. Some of these latter are clearly the work of village artists, and depict the miraculous escape of the peasantry from various calamities, and the preservation of their crops from floods, drought, lightning, and so forth. These poor wretches had done more to better their crops, by spending their savings in good ploughshares and harrows than by hanging Jew gauze on a wooden idol. The rector received us civilly, and showed us the treasury, full of jewels and costly plate, and the buildings where the pilgrims are lodged. Learned that the Gaiabilio or Centenary Festival of the Madonna is shortly to be celebrated with great pomp. The poorer classes delight in these ceremonies, and I am told this is to surpass all previous ones, the clergy intending to work on the superstitions of the people, and thus turn them against the new charter. It is said the Duke hopes to counteract these designs by offering a jewel diadem to the Virgin, but this will no doubt do him a bad turn with the esprit libres. These little states are as full of intrigues as a foul fruit of maggots. The 5th. To dinner at Count Tresker's, where, as usual, I was the plainest dressed man in the company, have long since ceased to be concerned by this. Why should a mere English farmer compete in elegance with these Monsignori and Illustrissimi? Surprised to find among the company my traveling companion of the other day. Learned that he is the Abate de Crucis, a personal friend of the Duke's. He greeted me cordially, and on hearing my name, said that he was acquainted with my works, in the translation of Mons. Freeville, and now understood how it was that I had got the better of him in our farming disputations on the way hither. Was surprised to be told by Count Tresker that the Duke desired me to wait on him that evening. Though in general not ambitious of such honors, yet in this case nothing could be more gratifying. The sixth. Yesterday evening to the palace, where His Highness received me with great affability. He was in his private apartments, with the Abate de Crucis and several other learned men, among them the famous Abate Crescenti, librarian to His Highness and author of the celebrated Chronicles of the Italian States. Happy indeed is the prince who surrounds himself with scholars instead of courtiers. Yet I cannot say that the impression His Highness produced on me was one of happiness. His countenance is sad, almost careworn, though with a smile of engaging sweetness. His manner affable without condescension, and open without familiarity. I am told he is oppressed by the cares of his station, and from a certain irresolution of voice and eye, that bespeaks not so much weakness as a speculative cast of mind, I can believe him less fitted for active government than for the meditations of the closet. He appears, however, zealous to perform his duties, questioned me eagerly about my impressions of Italy, and showed a flattering familiarity with my works, and a desire to profit by what he was pleased to call my exceptional knowledge of agriculture. I thought I perceived, in him a sincere wish to study the welfare of his people, but was disappointed to find among his chosen associates not one practical farmer or economist, but only the usual closet theorists that are too busy planning utopias to think of planting turnips. The seventh. Visited His Highness's estate at Valseca. Here he has converted a handsome seat into a school of agriculture, tearing down an immense orangery to plant mulberries, and replacing costly gardens and statuary by well-tilled fields. A good example to his wealthy subjects. Unfortunately, his bailiff is not what we should call a practical farmer, and many acres of valuable ground are given up to a botanic garden, where exotic plants are grown at great expense, and rather for curiosity than use. A common error of noble agriculturists. In the afternoon with the Abate de Crucis to the Benedictine monastery, a league beyond the city. Here I saw the best farming in the duchy. The prior received us politely, and conversed with intelligence on drainage, crops and irrigation. I urged on him the cultivation of turnips and he appeared struck by my arguments. The tenants on this great estate appeared better housed and fed than any I have seen in Pianura. The monks have a school of agriculture, less pretentious but better managed than the dukes. Some of them study physics and chemistry, and there are good chirurgeons among them, who care for the poor without pay. The aged and infirm peasants are housed in a neat almshouse, and the sick nursed in a clean well-built lazaret. Altogether an agreeable picture of rural prosperity, though I had rather it had been the result of free labor than of monastic bounty. The eighth. By appointment, to the Duke's Egeria. This lady, the Signorina F.V., having heard that I was in Pianura, had desired the Signor Andrea and I to bring me to her. I had expected a female of the loud declamatory type. Something of the Carilla Olympica order, but in this was agreeably disappointed. The Signorina V. is modestly lodged, lives in the frugal style of the middle class, and refuses to accept a title, though she is thus debarred from going to court. Were it not indiscreet to speculate on a lady's age, I should put hers at somewhat above 30. Though without the Duchess's commanding elegance as he has, I believe, more beauty of a quiet sort. A countenance at once soft and animated, agreeably tinged with melancholy, yet lit up by the incessant play of thought and emotion that succeed each other in her talk. Better conversation I never heard, and can heartily confirm the assurances of those who had told me that the lady was as agreeable in discourse as learned in the closet. Footnote. It has before now been observed that the free and volatile manners of foreign ladies tend to blind the English traveler to the inferiority of their physical charms. Note by a female friend of the author. On entering, found a numerous company assembled to compliment my hostess on her recent appointment as Doctor of the University. This is an honor not uncommonly conferred in Italy, where female learning, perhaps from its rarity, is highly esteemed. But I am told the ladies thus distinguished seldom speak in public, though their degree entitles them to a chair in the university. In the Signorina V.S. Society I found the most advanced reformers of the duchy. Among others Signor Gamba, the famous pamphleteer, author of a remarkable treatise on taxation, which had nearly cost him his liberty under the late Duke's reign. He is a man of extreme views and sarcastic tongue, with an irritability of manner that is perhaps the result of bodily infirmities. His ideas, I am told, have much weight with the fair doctoress, and in the lampoons of the day the new constitution is said to be the offspring of their amours, and to have inherited its father's deformity. The company presently withdrawing, my hostess pressed me to remain. She was eager for news from France, spoke admiringly of the new constitution, and recited in a moving manner an ode of her own composition on the fall of the Bastille. Though living so retired she makes no secret of her connection with the Duke, said he had told her of his conversation with me, and asked what I thought of his plan for draining the marsh of Pontesordo. On my attempting to reply to this in detail, I saw that, like some of the most accomplished of her sex, she was impatient of minutiae, and preferred general ideas to particular instances. But when the talk turned on the rights of the people I was struck by the energy and justice of her remarks, and by a tone of resolution and courage, that made me to say to myself, here is the hand that rules the state. She questioned me earnestly about the state of affairs in France, begged me to lend her what pamphlets I could procure, and while making no secret of her Republican sympathies, expressed herself with a moderation not always found in her sex. Of the clergy alone she appeared intolerant. A fact hardly to be wondered at, considering the persecution to which she and her father have been subjected. She detained me near 2 hours in such discourse, and on my taking leave asked with some show of feeling what I, as a practical economist, would advise the Duke to do for the benefit of his people, to which I replied, "Plant turnips, madam." And she laughed heartily, and said no doubt I was right. But I fear all the heads here are too full of fine theories to condescend to such simple improvements. 4.6. Fulvia, in the twilight, sat awaiting the Duke. The room in which she sat looked out on a stone-flagged cloister enclosing a plot of ground planted with yews, and at the farther end of this cloister a door communicated by a covered way with the ducal gardens. The house had formed a part of the convent of the Perpetual Adoration, which had been sold by the nuns when they moved to the new buildings the late Duke had given them. A portion had been torn down to make way for the Marquess of Cerveno's palace, and in the remaining fragment, a low building wedged between high walls, Fulvia had found a lodging. Her whole dwelling consisted of the abbess's parlor, in which she now sat, and the two or three adjoining cells. The tall presses in the parlor had been filled with her father's books, and surmounted by his globes and other scientific instruments. But for this the apartment remained as unadorned as in her predecessor's day, and Fulvia, in her austere black gown, with a long kerchief folded over her breast, and the unpowdered hair drawn back from her pale face, might herself have passed for the head of a religious community. She cultivated with almost morbid care the severity of dress and surroundings. There were moments when she could hardly tolerate the pale autumnal beauty which her glass reflected, when even this phantom of youth and radiance became a stumbling block to her spiritual pride. She was not ashamed of being the Duke of Pianura's mistress, but as he had a horror of being thought like the mistresses of other princes, she loathed all that the position represented in men's minds. As he had refused all that, according to the conventions of the day, it entitled her to claim wealth, patronage, and the rank and estates which it was customary for the sovereign to confer. As he had taken nothing from Odo but his love, and the little house in which he had lodged her. 3 years had passed since Fulvia's flight to Pianura. From the moment when she and Dodo had stood face to face again, it had been clear to him that he could never give her up, to her that she could never leave him. Fate seemed to have thrown them together in derision of their long struggle, and both felt that lassitude of the will which is the reaction from vain endeavor. The discovery that he needed her, that the task for which he had given her up could after all not be accomplished without her, served to overcome her last resistance. If the end for which both strove could best be attained together, if he needed the aid of her unfaltering faith as much as she needed that of his wealth and power, why should any personal scruple stand between them? Why should she who had given all else to the cause, ease, fortune, safety, and even the happiness that lay in her hand, hesitate to make the final sacrifice of a private ideal? According to the standards of her day, there was no dishonor to a woman in being the mistress of a man whose rank forbade his marrying her. The dishonor lay in the conduct which had come to be associated with such relations. Under the old dispensation, the influence of the prince's mistress had stood for the last excesses of moral and political corruption. Why might it not, under the new law, come to represent as unlimited a power for good? So love, the casuist, argued, and during those first months, when happiness seemed at last its own justification, Fulvia lived in every fiber. But always, even then, she was on the defensive against that higher tribunal which her own conception of life had created. In spite of herself, she was a child of the new era, of the universal reaction against the falseness and egotism of the old social code. A standard of conduct regulated by the needs of the race, rather than by individual passion, a conception of each existence as a link in the great chain of human endeavor, had slowly shaped itself out of the wild theories and vague oaths of the 18th century moralists. And with this sense of the sacramental nature of human ties, came a renewed reverence for moral and physical purity. Fulvia was of those who require that their lives shall be an affirmation of themselves, and the lack of inner harmony drove her to seek some outward expression of her ideals. She threw herself with renewed passion into the political struggle. The best, the only justification of her power, was to use it boldly, openly, for the good of the people. All the repressed forces of her nature were poured into this single channel. She had no desire to conceal her situation, to disguise her influence over Odo. She wished it rather, to be so visible a factor in his relations with his people, that she should come to be regarded as the ultimate pledge of his good faith. But, like all the casuistical virtues, this position had the rigidity of something created to fit a special case, and the result was a fixity of attitude, which spread benumbingly over her whole nature. She was conscious of the change, yet dared not struggle against it, since to do so was to confess the weakness of her case. As he had chosen to be regarded as a symbol, rather than a woman, and there were moments when she felt as isolated from life as some marble allegory in its niche above the marketplace. It was the desire to associate herself with the Duke's public life that had induced her, after much hesitation, to accept the degree which the university had conferred on her. As he had shared eagerly in the work of reconstructing the university, and had been the means of drawing to Pianura several teachers of distinction from Padua and Pavia, it was her dream to build up a seat of learning which should attract students from all parts of Italy. And though many young men of good family had withdrawn from the classes when the Barnabites were dispossessed, she was confident that they would soon be replaced by scholars from other states. She was resolved to identify herself openly with the educational reform which seemed to her one of the most important steps toward civic emancipation. And as he had therefore acceded to the request of the faculty that, on receiving her degree, she should sustain a thesis before the university. This ceremony was to take place a few days hence, on the Duke's birthday, and, as the new charter was to be proclaimed on the same day, Fulvia had chosen as the subject of her discourse the constitution recently promulgated in France. She pushed aside the bundle of political pamphlets which S.E. had been studying, and sat looking out at the strip of garden beyond the arches of the cloister. The narrow horizon bounded by convent walls symbolized fitly enough the life S.E. had chosen to lead. A life of artificial restraints and renunciations, passive, conventual almost, in which even the central point of her love burned, now, with a calm devotional glow. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.